This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people, some at the top of their game, others still climbing, all possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their visions. I'm not a journalist. I'm a deep thinker, a conversationalist. I won't be engaging my guests as a passive, neutral moderator. I have a perspective, an opinion on just about everything. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives. In this space, I hope to deepen, broaden, and sometimes even shift my own opinion by opening myself up to the thoughtful insights of others. I invite you to join me on this journey.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
In his new book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, Reverend Raphael G. Warnock, senior pastor of the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the spiritual home of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., discusses how a church formed in the quest for black personhood and freedom is now challenged by its own struggle between personal piety and social protest, a hyper-masculine black theology that has long stifled black women's voices, and the modern forces of white evangelicalism, black fundamentalism, and the prosperity gospel. With fresh eyes, he invites us to craft a new mission for today's black church. Today, we talk about his path to becoming one of today's most respected public theologians and his hopes for an emboldened black church that meets the needs of an ever-evolving body of Christ. Raphael, welcome to the AYG List.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here with you.
Let's start from your roots. You are a double preacher's kid from Savannah, Georgia. When did it occur to you that you were called to be a pastor, though?
I grew up in a very large family, the son of two Pentecostal preachers. There are 12 children in my family, seven boys, five girls. And faith was always a part of my life. I grew up in the church, but there was no pressure at all to go into ministry. But early on, I was drawn to the wonderful example of my father and later my mother, who went into ministry later. And I considered other options along the way. I was intellectually curious as a child, considered being a physician at one point. I was very much interested in science and technology, had an interest, a gift for the humanities. But ultimately and always, and in some sense, ministry was always there somewhere in my consciousness. And the older I became, the clearer it was that this was to be my calling. And it's one I've embraced with joy, and I've tried to embrace with a deep sense of commitment and faithful.
Well, that's evident. Your intellectual path, you to Morehouse College and Union Theological Seminary, where you studied under James Cone, the founder of Black Liberation Theology. How did attending the foremost training ground for black men in America and studying with the man who set forth the foundation for a spiritual interpretive lens that started from the African-American experience shape you into the public theologian you are now?
There's no doubt that attending Morehouse College and then later matriculating at Union Theological Seminary were two of the best decisions I ever made. Morehouse, as you might expect a Morehouse man to say, really is a very special place.
Mm-hmm.
It is a school that has a tradition of connecting the issues of head and heart, as Howard Thurman, one of our alumni, says, or that's the title of his autobiography, with head and heart. And in a real sense, that's been the mission of Morehouse College. Benjamin Elijah Mays, the famed president of Morehouse, wrote an article during his tenure or delivered a speech called Disturbed About Man. And he said that he was disturbed about man in the language of the androcentric language of the day, that when we train a man's head, we don't have any guarantee that we will also tune his heart. And that he was worried that if you shape the intellect, but you do not address the issues of ethics, you could end up with a kind of perverse genius that does more harm than help in the world. And so Morehouse has been a place that's been very serious about shaping leaders who are intellectually astute, but grounded also in a deep sense of service. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, embodies that, and it's hard really to walk through that place without coming out with a sense of commitment. At least it was for me. And then from there, went on to Union Theological Seminary, and as you said, trained with James Cone. I learned a great deal from Dr. Cone about the discipline of rigorous intellectual inquiry, of asking the faith hard questions as a kind of faithfulness itself. And so that shaped me in important ways. I think I knew even as I went to Union as a Master of Divinity student that I probably wanted to do a PhD. And that's what I did with the encouragement of Jim Cone and many others. And so here I am, standing somewhere between the church and the academy, primarily grounded, of course, in the church, but trying to speak ultimately to the issues in the public square, whether that is poverty or America's prison industrial complex, voting rights. All of these issues are important to me.
Well, you have served at some of the most revered and enduring black churches in the nation, including Sixth Avenue Baptist Church in Birmingham, Abyssinia Baptist Church in Harlem, and Douglas Memorial Church in Baltimore, before taking the helm at the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the spiritual home of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 2005, where at 35, actually, you were the fifth and youngest person to be called to pastor that church. How did each of these congregations define, expand, refine, and embolden your call to ministry?
Oh, those of us who go into ministry attend seminary, but you really learn how to be and to become a good pastor by spending time with the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've learned more from the people than any place else. I've been very, very blessed to have served some wonderful congregations, some historic congregations, churches that have been involved in the struggle for human rights and human dignity, beginning with Sixth Avenue Baptist Church. I grew up in the Pentecostal church, so there I was grounded in a kind of spiritual piety that continues to shape my life, but went on to Sixth Avenue Baptist Church, was licensed and ordained there by the Reverend Dr. John Porter, who had been a pulpit assistant to Martin Luther King Jr., a young Dr. King, in his earliest days at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. John Porter was his pulpit assistant even before the Montgomery bus boycott was launched and a young ML, as they called him, was thrust into history. So I was ordained by this man, and then I went on to Abyssinian Baptist Church, again a congregation with a storied history of activism and community service, demonstrated in the ministries of Adam Clayton Powell Sr., who was a black social gospeler, and Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who took the activism and the social consciousness of his father to another level and became, at the height of his career, a very effective congressperson for Harlem. Again, a congregation, a ministry that allowed faith to make its way into the public square, statements about who we are and who we ought to become, a kind of social vision, but grounded in a moral framework. I saw that at Abyssinian with the legacy of Adam Powell, Senior and Junior, the legacy of Samuel DeWitt Proctor, who succeeded Adam Powell at that church, an activist, college president, mentor to Jesse Jackson and so many others. And while there, I served under the leadership and the mentorship of the Reverend Dr. Calvin Butts, from whom I learned a great deal about how to both be a faithful pastor and a social prophet at the same time.
You are the embodiment of a public theologian and have very ardently engaged in the social issues that have defined these times, from voting rights in the state of Georgia and for Katrina evacuees from Louisiana to creating progressive urban ministry programs that use the barbershop atmosphere for men and car washing to share the gospel of Christ, to standing up very publicly for Janarlo Wilson and Troy Davis. You do not shy away from any of the issues of the day. As evidenced by your taking an HIV test in front of your entire congregation, you very much see yourself as an activist pastor. What led you to such a public profession of your faith in this bold way?
Oh, I don't know how else to do ministry. I mean, ministry by its very nature is public, and it ought to push against the grain of the mores of the society and push us to a higher level of consciousness. And so that's why I sat down publicly to take an HIV/AIDS test first while serving as pastor of the Douglas Memorial Community Church in Baltimore. That was my first church after leaving Abyssinia, and that was the first church I served as a senior pastor. And I actually began my installation and inauguration, if you will, as pastor of that church with a weekend focused on the issue of HIV/AIDS. Had a conference, kicked off my installation with a conference on the Black Church's response to HIV/AIDS. When I went to Baltimore, I was struck by just the high rate of HIV/AIDS incidents in that community, much of it driven by intravenous drug use, as well as the intersection of intravenous drug use and human sexual behavior. But there were pockets, at least when I was there, there were pockets or sections of Baltimore where the HIV/AIDS numbers, we were told then, rivaled some parts of sub-Saharan Africa.
Yep.
And so I didn't see how I could go to Baltimore and not give voice to this issue that I'd been concerned about and had been addressing for a number of years, but this time as a senior pastor of a church. And then went on to Atlanta and did the same thing at the Ebenezer Baptist Church. The gospel for me is good news to the poor who seek liberation and the poor in spirit who seek transformation in a broken and unjust world. And so I'm always trying to live between the poles of individual salvation and personal piety, spiritual formation on the one hand, and social justice and social transformation on the other. In fact, one ought to feed the other. Each ought to feed the other.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dr. King embodied that in his ministry and in his life, and it's something that I've tried to embody. I think it's at core, it's what the gospel is about.
Yes. Gender equality and the embrace of the LGBT community seem to be issues hotly contested in the Black church, while many see other issues such as infidelity and hypocrisy as largely overlooked by many in that ministry. These issues, along with the prison industrial complex, HIV/AIDS, drug addiction, the war on drugs, homelessness, the millions of families trying to survive without a living wage, and glaring and racial and class disparities are all issues you believe the Black church must give itself over to. In your new book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, you exhibit in great detail why a church founded on forging freedom for African Americans is today woefully out of alignment with its original mission and the complex needs of those who seek out the Black church for healing, substance, guidance, and leadership. Why did you write this book?
Oh, it's my manifesto. It's my sense of what ministry, again, is all about. And not even just the Black church.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I think, as a systematic theologian, part of what I wrestle with is, what is the meaning of the faith?
Mm-hmm.
How do we know when we're being faithful? How do we know when we are an authentic witness to what Jesus represents in the world? And as I struggled with that question, the book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, demonstrates where I come out on that question. My focus is on the gospel. I see the gospel at its core as about liberation. It's about liberation. It's about freedom. It's about human dignity and wholeness. And you can't speak to that issue in a kind of truncated way that separates people's bodies from their souls. That's what those who enslaved us aim to do. Anytime we separate spiritual matters from the issues of just human wholeness, the ability to have access to food and clean water and health care, when we spiritualize the faith in such a way that we say, well, those are worldly issues and those are they're not issues that the church ought to be concerned about, we distort the meaning of the faith. And and African Americans particularly ought to remember that that was an ideology, this disembodied approach to the faith that does not take seriously the human body and human community, this kind of faith that doesn't take seriously one's cultural identity and socio-political reality, one's sense of oneself even as a sexual being, any kind of faith that, that is in denial about all of these things ultimately will not be very helpful to us. And so what I'm part of why I wrote the book is I'm worried about the black church, a church that in many ways has been radical on race and conservative on just about every other issue.
Right.
And so part of my message to the church that I love is that your voice, even on the issue of race, is severely compromised. Your moral credibility is compromised. If you speak on the issue of racism but do not understand or will not willingly see the relationship between racism and all of these other, and all of these issues, including climate change. There are too many in our community, and I understand, you know, that we are inundated with so many problems, and it's difficult to know where to focus. And many have seen climate change and the issues of the environment as a kind of white middle class and upper class issue. And in a sense, I understand where they're coming from. If you have all of your material needs met and then some, there's not much to worry about except if the planet itself disintegrates.
Yeah.
But the irony is that poor people in urban centers like Atlanta and Baltimore and New York and Los Angeles and throughout the third world and in Africa and Asia, the irony is that poor people, those who benefit the least from the technology that's causing rapid climate change and doing damage to our Earth, are the ones who are suffering and will suffer the most if we don't get a handle on these issues.
Sure.
And so this is why, in the spirit of Martin King, I have tried to put forth in my ministry, in my theological thinking as a theologian, in my preaching as a pastor, a multifaceted, multidimensional understanding of the human predicament. Martin Luther King Jr., in the short 13 years of his public ministry, used to talk about the triplet evils of racism, poverty, and militarism. And in a very credible way, he articulated and demonstrated the relationship between each of those issues, that he refused to allow people to put him in a box so that he was speaking about race but not speaking about the Vietnam War. He had enough insight to realize that the war that we needed to wage against poverty in America was crippled in part by the fact that we were busy waging war against the poor in Vietnam. And so in our own era, in our own time, in our own moment, we have to see that we can't talk about racism and ignore the issues that black women are dealing with and black children. How do you ignore half of the race and talk in a credible way about systemic racism?
Right.
How do you talk about the suffering and the issues confronting people of African descent while ignoring black children? How do you talk about the black church on the one hand and gays and lesbians on the other without recognizing that it's not a situation in which the church is over here and gay and lesbian people are over there? No, actually, they're in our churches.
Yeah.
And it's about time for us to have an honest conversation about it.
Yeah, and you started beautifully in your book. It is 2014, and the black church is becoming defined. No, let me say this. It's 2014, and the black church and the church writ large is becoming defined publicly more by megachurches and reality shows and scandal more than effectively shining a light on the gospel of Jesus Christ. There are so many conversations, Raphael, that I've had with people of faith who are just tired and who also are becoming less trusting of the churches that we went to when we were younger for that kind of spiritual grounding and that kind of spiritual integrity. So this seems to counter your desire, as stated in your new book, to see the Black church engaged in an action-oriented theology that has teeth when responding to the spiritual needs of your parishioners, as well as the immense social justice issues that comprise what you call the central issues of human life. I want to talk to you, and maybe this can be sort of an exchange, about how we then bridge the gap between theologians, those who are thinking about this, writing about it in a scholarly context in very rigorous ways, pastors who are in congregations, who are leading flocks of people weekly, and hopefully more than on Sunday, you know, and parishioners. I feel like the body of Christ, as we call it, each of those groups has a responsibility to have more than a conversation, more than a tweet, more than a Facebook post about this profession of faith, if it is to have teeth and if it's to shape not only our spiritual lives, but also if it is to shape the public policy that you speak up so eloquently around us.
No, I absolutely agree, but I think it does begin with a conversation. And I know that there's a lot of talking going on, but part of the problem that I try to underscore in the divided mind of the Black church is that while there's a lot of talking going on, in the case of Black pastors on the one hand and Black and womanist theologians on the other, each group is too busy talking among themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that has implications for the very problem that you're talking about. Black theologians are academic, critical, religious intellectuals, those who teach in seminaries and have the luxury of thinking about things in a kind of sustained way that most people don't.
Yeah.
On the one hand, and then the pastors who are practitioners who are there in the trenches working with our people day after day are not talking to each other. Each has retreated to relative enclaves of privilege,
mm-hmm.
Pastoral privilege, academic privilege. And that has consequences for the community. Because Black theologians and Black pastors are not talking, it seems to me that the Black church has lost its mind, meaning its ability to think critically about the faith, and to think about what is it that has made it a special church? What is it that has made it a gift, I believe, to America? And what is the difference between the evangelical kind of sensibility that has come out of our churches and in the testimony of slaves and the uncritical evangelicalism that holds sway in American politics and has been responsible for so much damage, not just in America, but across the
globally.
World.
Uh-huh.
So the Black church has lost or is losing its mind because it's not talking to its critical theologians, the best of its intellectual minds. And in some ways, it's suspicious of that whole program. On the other hand, Black theology and womanist theology, in my estimation, have lost their heart. That is, the willingness to actually change the world.
Well, I'm sorry for interrupting you earlier because it just struck
no problem.
Me. It's, what exactly, I mean, because, you know, you and I were in grad school in religion and in theology around the same time, and it seems to me that in a very short period of time that we've become entrenched in these camps. I went to Harvard Divinity School in the mid-90s, and it felt like the sense of possibility that I felt while I was in that intellectual environment and what was going to happen for those types of conversations that are definitely needed to move anyone into action that's actually going to shift systemic issues that we're facing. I thought it was really, really, really bold and brave, and it was just open. And then all of a sudden, you know, I look around today and I see people like you, my friends like you and Monica Coleman, all of these people who are engaged in a robust, generative conversation and lived experience of faith and ministry and intellectual engagement. I just feel like what is happening and where are the disconnects? So you've been in it. You've got a lot of skin in the game. What are you thinking? What happened? I mean, you know that there was this big meeting where there was supposed to be this conversation about the history of the Black church, and nary a woman was present in 2013. And I saw a lot of my sisters in the ministry were, not only were they insulted intellectually and spiritually by it, but there was a wounding. Like, I felt like the response was like they were mortally, like, wounded, like, all of this work, and we're still not making this progress. So my question is, where do you think the break is? And more importantly, and I know that you all and I in some way, we all have the power to heal this wound. How do we, where did the break come and how do we heal this?
Well, I think that in a real sense, April, the disconnect has been there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was there before we came to seminary. And, so it's a problem that I talk about. I mean, as early as the 1970s, there were some in the Black theology movement, Gayrod, Wilmore, and others, who were concerned already that if they allowed that what was a movement to evolve into an elite circle of theoreticians, that it would lose some of its soul. And I think that has played itself out.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, I was a part of some of those exciting conversations that you're talking about while in seminary, and it shaped my life and my worldview. But at the same time, I was clear even then that there was not the connection that I would have liked to see in the church, which is why I was teaching Black theology classes as a graduate student over at Abyssinian Baptist Church. I set up an institute, and there are other examples of people doing that kind of intentional work. And I brought Jim Cone, Dr. Cone, and others over to Abyssinian. So those were things that were going on, by the way, in the Black theology movement early in its history. But at some point, the movement shifted from the NCBC, which was more of an activist, clergy/theologian-led organization, focused not just on critical reflection, but actually changing the world. If you look through the footnotes of some of the footnotes in my book, you'll see some of the statements that NCBC was making, some of the issues that they were actually standing up on. But Black theology shifted from that kind of organic intellectual enterprise represented by the NCBC to the Society for the Study of Black Religion. And I don't have anything against the Society for the Study of Black Religion, but we need what I call a fifth moment. We need a conversation that brings the best of our theological minds, the passion and institutional strength of the church, and all of that needs to be sourced by the people in our community, those in the hip-hop community, the folks who are most marginalized by all of these discussions. We need their insights to be brought to bear on where we are in this moment and where do we go from here. Aside from that, I have to tell you that as a pastor, I spend most of my time trying to do it.
Yes.
I think I just try to do it. If I see something that needs to be addressed, I say it. If, you know, I stood up for Gennaro Wilson for him, to be sure, but also as a way of pointing to a larger issue, and that is America's prison industrial complex. I think we have to find ways to engage both in critical reflection and praxis. We have to talk about it, think about it, but at some point we have to do it, and it's in the doing, I think, that we come to understand more clearly what we ought to do. Doing and thinking are inextricably connected, and I think we all have to find ways to embody that somehow in whatever it is we do.
You are the head of a wonderful church that has a wonderful congregation and very active and engaged. Do you have a sense of what's happening in the larger body of Christ with folks who just feel very disconnected from the way in which modern church life is evolving, who are feeling a little spiritually confused and spiritually lost and don't feel anchored, not only in the Black church, but in the church in general? Do you have a sense of that? And how does that inform your call to pastor, your call to being a leader in the body of Christ?
Well, it's a very complicated issue. And the issues and the reasons for the disconnect, the sense of alienation probably vary from person to person. But there's some larger themes, I think, writ large in our culture. I mean, we are going through major shifts in this postmodern moment. You know, I think part of what people in our generation and younger insist on, and it's not unique, but I think they give voice to it in a particular way, is people really are in search of something that is and feels and looks authentic.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are in a deep search and hunger and desire to hear what Howard Thurman used to call the sound of the genuine. And there's so much window dressing. Look at our political leaders. I mean, everybody's kind of going over their talking points, and the posturing goes on. And if you have a certain point of view, you can find that reinforced on your particular cable channel.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, America's dealing with some really, really serious problems. And same thing with the church.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of kind of superficial religiosity going on. But in people's everyday lives, there's a deep sense of angst and a desire to connect, which I think is why, you know, I mean, people do have a desire for community, and they do have a deep, deep hunger for things spiritual. I'm sure you hear it. I hear it all the time. You know, I don't do that church thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just spiritual. And, you know, as a Christian, as a pastor, I try to help people to understand, well, you know, you may be spiritual, but part of spirituality is being connected to some kind of faith community. That's where that stuff gets worked out, issues about love and compassion and patience and long suffering. you need to spend some time with some other pilgrims on the journey.
Mm-hmm.
in order to weigh in on where you are on those issues. But I think people are in search of the authentic. I think we live in the on-demand generation, where whatever it is you want, you can get it on demand. When you and I were growing up, I used to come home and my father, no matter what was going on in the house, everything stopped at 6:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
He sat stoically in front of the box television set to hear Walter Cronkite tell us what was going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays, you and I watch the news whenever we want, and we see it on our phone, we see it on our iPad, and while we're watching it, there's a ticker tape and some other things going on. So it's a different world, and I think the church has to find a way to speak the eternal truth of the gospel in that context into that world.
Hmm. Thank you for speaking to that. It is January the 15th, 2014. Today would have been Martin Luther King's 85th birthday. As an heir to the spiritual pulpit of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., do you feel emboldened or overwhelmed by the enormity of living in his light?
I feel incredibly privileged and blessed and honored to serve as the senior pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, spiritual home of Dr. King. I think part of the reason why we at Ebenezer, and I really do mean we, the Ebenezer congregation, the reason why we've been able to achieve some things over the last 8 years of my pastorate is that I was very clear going in that it really isn't my job, as some have asked me, you know, what does it feel like to walk in Dr. King's shoes? Well, part of what I've been very clear about it is that it was never my responsibility or my task to walk in Dr. King's shoes or anybody's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
My incredible privilege is to stand on his shoulders rather than to try to walk in his shoes. You know, and part of how I think about this, and I know I mentioned Howard Thurman and Dr. King in this conversation a few times, but, you know, both were graduates of my beloved alma mater, Morehouse College. And Howard Thurman graduated from Morehouse in the 1920s. I can't remember. I think it was either 1923 or 26. And Martin Luther King Jr. graduated in 1948. So when Dr. King came along and began to discover his voice as a preacher, Howard Thurman was already pretty well established as a thoughtful Christian leader and communicator. And I sometimes wonder what would have happened and what would the movement have looked like had Dr. King tried to sound like Howard Thurman.
Mm.
I mean, he was certainly worthy of emulation. How long would what would have the I have what would the I Have a Dream speech sound like if Howard Thurman were delivering it?
Right.
What I'm saying is that the genius of Dr. King is that he discovered his own voice.
Yes.
For his own time. And so, and he stood on the shoulders of those who came before him. His father was an activist in his own right who led a voting rights campaign in Atlanta in 1935. His grandfather, the second pastor of Ebenezer, A.D. Williams, fought for the first school for black children in Atlanta. Dr. King attended the high school, he and his siblings, that existed only because of the activism of his father. And so he stood on the shoulders of activists who came before him. And so our job, our responsibility in this moment is to find our voices and our passion around the issues that have to do with human dignity and human liberation, find a way to speak and give voice to the best in the human spirit.
Gorgeous answer. If you were not a public theologian, who would you be?
Who would I be or what would I be?
What would you be? Who would you be? Either way you want to respond to it.
Wow. I can't imagine doing anything else.
Okay.
Honestly, I feel called to what I do and blessed to do it. I think if I weren't a preacher, I'd find some other way to serve.
How can people find you on social media?
I'm on Facebook. I've got a couple of Facebook pages. I think my like page is Reverend Raphael G. Warnock, Ph.D. My Twitter handle is at Raphael Warnock. And I am on both, and I send out my own tweets and my
All
own
right.
Facebook posts. And so I'd love to be in conversation with your listeners.
That's great. And as a bonus, Reverend Warnock has been generous enough to offer one of our listeners a signed copy of his book. So go to the AYG list on Facebook, like our page, and there'll be a question that I'll ask you to answer. And based on the answers to the question, Reverend Warnock and I will select who will get this book. So thank you so much for being generous to the audience today and giving out a copy of your fantastic book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church. Reverend Raphael Warnock, Ph.D., public theologian, inspirational preacher, senior pastor at the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, and my friend, thank you for joining me today on the AYG list.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG List posts every Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG List. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening.